Listeners, it's NaNoWriMo season, which means thousands of writers are plotting and drafting thousands of books even as we speak. When they write the words, the end, a whole lot of them are going to need help to get their manuscript in shape for wherever they want to go with it. If that sounds like catnip to you, you should check out bookcoaches.com/amwriting, where our sponsor, Author Accelerator, offers the training you need to turn your passion for stories into a full-blown side gig or business. You'll find all the info, as well as a free video series to help you decide if book coaching is right for you, at bookcoaches.com/amwriting.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. I don't remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3.
Okay.
Welcome to the Hashtag Am Writing podcast. This is the podcast about writing all the things. Queries, proposals, nonfiction, fiction, novels, short stories, all the things you can write. This is the show about sitting down and getting the work done. I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and the forthcoming The Addiction Inoculation, Raising Healthy Kids in a Culture of Dependence that will be out on April 6, 2021. And I also write for The Washington Post and Airmail, and I had a column at The New York Times for 3 years and have written for The Atlantic, lots of places. Anyway, I am on my own today because, full disclosure, Serena and I recorded a lovely podcast with our guest that I will describe in a moment, and our primary, secondary, and tertiary modes of recording failed in various ways. Thank you, technology. So this is just me today with a guest, and I hope you enjoy the show. Today, I get to talk to Lacey Crawford about her book, Notes on a Silencing. I am so excited to talk to Lacey. I got to do a book event with her. I found out about her book, I believe, through a Vanity Fair article. It may have even been before the Vanity Fair article came out that was an excerpt, but we're going to be talking about that today. But Lacey has been a writer for a good long time. She has a novel that I really loved, a satire called Early Decision that came out in 2013. And she has written for lots of places. And her Notes on a Silencing, the book I really want to talk about today, was named one of the best books of the summer by Time, People, Real Simple. It was an editor's choice at the New York Times. I mean, this is I cannot recommend the book Notes on a Silencing enough. It is, yes, it is a dark topic. It is so beautifully written, however, that I think even people who are, I know during this time, we're still in the middle of this COVID thing, a lot of people are like, oh, I'm only reading about happy things. But there was so much in this book that I found inspiring, and even, I don't know, there's even some optimism in there. Anyway, Lacey Crawford, welcome to the show. And by the way, just really quickly, I want to acknowledge that this is the second time we're recording this interview. But Lacey, it's going to be so much better this time, right?
Thank you for having me back. Yeah.
The reason I wanted to talk to Lacey today about this book, Notes on a Silencing, and about her career in general, and sort of I'm going to give her an opportunity to introduce the book to you, is that when I talked with Lacey for another event about this book, we talked about the process of going through legal with her publisher. And we've also talked about fact checking. And there was an article that I will put in the show notes that was bounced around Twitter recently on the lack of fact checking in nonfiction from the publisher's perspective, that the publisher does not do a lot of fact checking. And yet, as Lacey found out, and as I am finding out, there's a lot more that goes on if you publish excerpts or if you're publishing in a magazine. So we want to talk about legal. We want to talk about fact checking. We really want to talk about the tension between the two, because I had no idea until I talked to Lacey about this. So Lacey, could you give us a quick introduction to the background for Notes on a Silencing and tell us just sort of what the book's about and how it landed on my desk in this wonderful, beautiful form that it's in?
I absolutely, and thank you for your kind words about it. I do want to say that there's pretty sensitive content, and I'm going to run through in a quick overview the events that led to the writing of the book. Anyone who is uncomfortable hearing about sexual assault or not in the mood today, now is the time to choose something else.
Or in the car with your kids.
Yes, now is the time to choose something else and stay safe. For everyone else, when I was 15 years old and a junior at St. Paul's School, which is a sort of so-called elite New England boarding school, I was sexually assaulted by two 18-year-old seniors. It was a statutory assault, which meant that consent was a moot point because of our age differences, but I did not consent either. I contracted a sexually transmitted disease deep in my throat as a result of that assault. I went to the infirmary of my school. My infirmary, the doctors there, diagnosed what was wrong with me, but chose not to tell me or my family or my physicians at home, such that I was sick for the next 6 months until I was able to tell my mother what had finally happened to me, at which point my pediatrician at home in Chicago reported the assault to the school and to the state of New Hampshire. But my boarding school had already determined that they would shut this down. And the way they did that effectively was by invading my medical records, slandering me on campus, lying to lawyers, and I mean, it's a little bit more complicated than that, but
Well, to be clear, though, I mean, from a very the thing that's always so stark to me is that your school knew you had a sexually transmitted disease before you did.
Before I did. They knew for 6 months before I did. That's right. And they actually told my peers about it. And I should be very clear that I had contracted herpes, genital herpes, very, very deep in my throat in a place that could not be seen on ordinary exam. I have never seen a sore because it's too far down my throat. So it was clinical evidence of the assault, and the school knew it. In any case, they threatened if I agreed to testify against my rapist, because the police in Concord, New Hampshire wanted to bring charges against them, the school threatened to expel me for my senior year. I would not be welcome back on campus. That's clear witness tampering. But we didn't know this 30 years ago when I was then 16 years old and at home in Chicago and wanted to go back to high school. But the events of that year shaped my life and shaped my understanding of myself. And I thought I had put them behind me as best I could when in 2017, the state of New Hampshire opened a formal investigation into St. Paul's School. So the attorney general initiated a formal investigation because so many accounts of assault on campus had come forward. Some had risen to prominence in national media, most particularly Chessie Prout, who was assaulted as a 15-year-old freshman by Owen Labrie, who was ultimately convicted on, I think, 3 of 5 charges and sent to prison for a short period of time. In the course of that state investigation, the attorney general asked for anybody who had experience of the school silencing victims or failing to protect children in its care to come forward. I did so very privately, was sent to work with the Concord Police Department, was interviewed, a new criminal case file was opened. They pulled the criminal case file from 1990. In the course of all of this, Concord Police discovered documented evidence of how the school and its lawyers had worked to silence me. And once that evidence was revealed, the Attorney General's office refused to admit it into its state investigation, would not give me a reasonable explanation for why that was. The police were furious and read to me from my file so that I would have the truth. And then the state investigation was closed and no charges were brought or announced against anyone on the campus of St. Paul's then or now. So I was effectively silenced, and I had been silenced once when I was 15, 16 years old by this school. And now I was being silenced again by an attorney general and other attorneys that I had never met who had nothing to do with the school. And I thought, you know, the hell you do. You're not going to get away with this twice. So I wrote my memoir, Notes on a Silencing, which is a bit about the assault, although the assault was quite ordinary. It is very much about how a community failed to hear the story, to bear witness to the story of what had happened to me. And I silenced myself, too. So I found it very difficult to find words for what had happened to me. The reason to go into some of this is because it gives a sense that there's some very sensitive information that I wrote in my memoir, including describing crimes that were committed, you know, to me, and the crimes that were then described to me that are written down on the page. So all of these things are dangerous, frankly, for someone to put
dangerous. Dangerous for you, dangerous for other people. I mean, there's no shortage of people who over time would sort of weigh in on whether or not you should be able to write about these things or savor certain things. So when we talked about this before, Serena and you talked about the fact that when you sign a contract to publish a book, that there's an indemnification that the publisher sort of puts there in the contract saying that we are not responsible for legally for the stuff that might be in this book. So that sets up a really interesting situation, because from the outset, if you read your contract carefully, it's very right. clear that you're on your own when it comes to the facts of a book.
That's right. So what that means is that ultimately liability rests with the author. So if there were to be a lawsuit brought, and it would effectively be a defamation case, right? And I'm not a lawyer. I think you are, Jess. But
I never practiced, and it's been a very, very long time.
If somebody can prove that they have been defamed by something that you have written in your book, you have yourself a problem. So the greatest risk, I think, with a legal review is a defamation suit that would be brought. And the publishing houses do, and the fine print of the contracts basically shift that liability ultimately to the author. You assume full responsibility. In my case, my husband and I ended up hiring a private attorney to protect me, to have on retainer and to protect me, because the events that I was reporting on in my memoir were so likely to be provocative to people who...
Was your attorney reading it as you were writing it, or was this something that your attorney sort of read at the end, or...
This is fascinating, and I don't think I could have written it, or certainly not written it the way I did, if there had been attorneys reading it then. I think this is the tricky part, is in order to write something well, at least for me, particularly if you are calling on deep reserves of memory, and particularly if you are working through a lot of complicated ambivalence with regard to shame or guilt or any other negative emotions that might revolve around these events, if you are constantly having to defend yourself to a lawyer in your head, in addition to the editor in your head, your mom in your head, you know, all of these other people in your head, you're going to get nowhere. You're going to get nowhere. And my agent actually said to me at one point, because I was like, Sarah, man, I am putting it out there, you know, and I don't know that she's, and she said, we're going to worry about that later. You're gonna write the book now, and we're gonna worry about that later. She said, you have a First Amendment right to say what is true. That is true. That is correct. But what is true is, of course, a whole mishigas that, you know,
there's your truth. I mean, and again, we can go to Mary Carr's book about writing memoir. We can go all these places to talk about, you know, perception of truth and all that sort of stuff. So there a lot of arguing can happen over what is true and what is not.
Exactly. So what you want to do with the legal review, in my experience, is try to eliminate the possibility that you have to have those conversations, is try to effectively bulletproof your book so that any of the allegations you make on the page, and an allegation needn't be criminal. It can simply be that you depicted someone in a way that they don't care for, in a way that they consider to be offensive or insulting, or that they could possibly claim has hurt them in some way. Maybe their boss read the book and has different feelings about them. Maybe their partner read the book and has different feelings about them. Those are real issues and real concerns. So with regard to fact-checking, and I think you've said this, Justin, this is, of course, the subject of that article, which is an astonishing thing nevertheless. Publishers do not include fact-checkers as a core function. You have your editor and your proofreader and your copy editor and your typesetter, but there is nobody who is going to fact-check your book for you. So whether or not things are factual is up to you. With regard to a memoir, it is understood, and different houses do it differently, but it is understood that people remember things differently. So my editor and I talked over and over about, should I hire a fact-checker privately? Would that give
And many authors do. Many of my friends have.
Of course. And it's incredibly smart to do that if you can. It's very expensive. It will eat up in advance pretty quickly, right?
And especially when added into having a lawyer on retainer for your book. I mean, we're talking about a lot of money invested in before the book ever happens.
That's exactly right. And I do think that for certain genres of nonfiction, fact-checking is critical. So if you're writing a biography, you wouldn't want to put that out into the world without fact-checking. If you are an investigative reporter, you would never put anything into the world in book form without elaborate fact-checking, and that's fantastic. Memoirs are different, and the reason memoirs are different is because they are understood to be subjective. It is a different genre of book. So as someone said to me, if we fact-checked memoirs, memoirs would never get published. Because enough people would have enough problems with basic inaccuracies, which are not salient. They're not core, you know, to the book. But someone can say, that's not what color my car was.
Right.
And you can spend the rest of your life, you know, trying to get that clear. So I did not hire a fact checker. The legal review for my book was complicated. And I think legal reviews are complicated. I was corresponding with another author from a different house, a very prestigious house, who has a nonfiction book coming out next year. And they have they have counsel outside of their house, the publishing house I worked with. They have in-house counsel. So these are publishing attorneys who go through manuscripts all day long, looking for potential challenges, potential problems. And what they're reading for, in my understanding, is an eye for where I might have depicted a certain person in a way, as I said, that would lead to a charge of defamation. So they're not reading it to see if I'm telling the truth. They're assuming that I am telling my truth. That is absolutely understood. But they are reading to see, well, can you actually say this? Can you actually say this? So a very obvious situation for me was I depicted the sexual assault and I described the men who assaulted me. Now, in real life, those two men were interviewed as part of the investigation in 2018, and they admitted to the facts of my assault. Now, they claimed it was consensual, and I, on the page, said they claimed it was consensual, right? So I put their truth on the page as well. But I was able to depict what they had done to me because, in part, they had already admitted to those things. Mm-hmm. If that had not happened, I think it would have been much more difficult for me to describe not the assault, perhaps, but give the details that I gave about who they were. Mm-hmm. I did not name them. That was my choice. If I had chosen to name them, that would have been a whole other level, you know, of legal consideration. Will they come after me for this? Will they challenge this in some way? Who wouldn't, right? There were many places in the book where the legal pushback was, I would have drawn a conclusion that was undoubtedly true. For example, there was a rector of St. Paul's School, a headmaster, who was removed effectively for embezzling funds. He had managed to create a little slush fund of several million dollars that no one could explain, that seemed to be funding his yacht club and a nice house in Maine. And his, you know, salary had gone from benchmarked normal to $500,000 a year. And a lot of people at the school were concerned about this. So I had written very briefly about this person, who does not figure centrally in my book, that he had been removed after financial improprieties. Mm-hmm. And the legal department looked up the reporting on his removal from St. Paul's School, and that was never reported, financial impropriety. What was reported was he was removed following a financial investigation. And if you're a lawyer, there's an ocean of difference between writing financial impropriety and removed following a financial investigation. Obviously, he's guilty as hell. That's why they fired him. But I don't get to say that unless somebody else has said it first. So I was really surprised because I said, well, but he did that. And they said, no, we know he did that. And he knows he did that. But you aren't going to be the one who says it.
Right.
Because that's now, just an, yeah.
So, well, that's the thing, is that there's sort of knowledge that's accepted within the community, and then there's knowledge that, you know, has actually been stated in fact. And the tricky part about this for you is that there's, and I was sitting talking with Tim, because we had this conversation with you before and it didn't get recorded. And so since then, I've been obsessively thinking about my book and did I do a good enough job of hiding the identities of certain people? And my husband has to do this all the time too, because he writes about patients, right? So what's the standard for whether or not someone is recognizable? And the sticky spot in this for you is that everyone at the school knew who these people were, who you were, and the various iterations of what people said happened by way of the social telephone, which is, of course, a nightmare. So it's not which is interesting to me, because you're being held to one standard for the public, and yet on the other side, everyone that's involved in this book knows who you're talking about.
Exactly. And so there are legal considerations, and then there are ethical considerations, right? So you can get away with a lot legally that might not be ethical.
Right.
You know, you if truth is a defense against defamation, you can write something that's true. If you're willing to back it up, if you're able to back it up, you know, with documents or recordings or whatever it is, you can say it. Absolutely. But do you want to do that? Is that the right thing to do?
Right.
Of course not. So in my case, it was forever a question of good faith. What is the best faith approach to this situation? And where I was depicting someone negatively, there are none of the students in my book are named, with the exception of one who gave me permission, who's a close friend, and another who has died. So this is Sarah Devins, you know, about whom I reported only life facts, and who also, by the way, was depicted very, very positively because she was wonderful to me. Where there were students who did not behave in an ideal manner, you know, the ethical consideration is, look, they were 15, you know, and all of us have done things when we were 15 that we would rather not have appear in a memoir. In those cases, one goes to some great lengths to change the identity of these people in a way that is yet consistent with your narrative, right? So if the fundamental power dynamic between the boys who assaulted you and you was that they were older than you were and they were captains of, let's say, the ice hockey and lacrosse team, you can't say they were captains of the ice hockey and lacrosse team, because then everybody will know who they were. But you still want to find a way to preserve
that.
That's exactly right. You want to find a way to preserve that power differential. So you have to make them, in a sense, big men on campus, right? So you end up making little changes and coming up with these elaborate workarounds. And there were other places where my lawyers at Hachette at Little Brown said, you know, it's worth disguising small facts simply because people will be recognizable to themselves, probably, but there's no point in making them recognizable to anybody else. So there was, for example, a boyfriend I had who's depicted in the pages who had an older sister who picked me up at the airport once. And she actually picked me up in a purple Carmen Ghia, and she was barefoot. And this was part of this fabulous summer experience I had. And the lawyer said, it wasn't really a purple Carmen Ghia, was it? And I said, no, it was. It was a purple Carmen Ghia. I was very proud of my memory. You know, I remember. That's why I get to write a memoir. And she said, oh my God, well, you don't make it, you know. So I changed it to, you know, a leaf green MG or something. I said, but all she did was pick me up at the airport. There's nothing else that she does. Right. Why would I not depict the car she's in? And the lawyer said, why would you? Why on earth, you know, would you make it as clear?
Well, because from a writing perspective,
yes,
a purple Carmen Ghia and barefoot is totally different from a silver Audi with loafers. It's just a different
writing. Exactly. So this is why she's barefoot. I got to keep her barefoot in a leaf green MG. Right. But I had to actually call some car people and ask them, you know, what's the aesthetic comparison from a purple Carmen Ghia? Anyway, so it takes a long time. And this is why I recommend not even thinking about this process until you've gotten your own story down on the page, because I do think it would be almost impossible. But then a really fascinating thing happened, and that is this. We sold first serial rights, otherwise known as an excerpt of my memoir, to Vanity Fair.
And just to clarify, since a listener asked us about this recently, first serial rights means that one place and one place only gets the rights to publish the excerpt right when the book comes out. And that's usually, sometimes worth some money to the publisher or to the author. Sometimes it's used to offset an advance. Sometimes a percentage goes to the author and a percentage goes to the publisher. But either way, it is the thing you try to sell in advance of the publication of the book. Okay, back to our story.
it amounts to fantastic free publicity for your book.
Right.
And sometimes it's not just free, but they pay you for it, as you said, right? So I was very, very lucky. Now, here's where things got kind of wild. I had gone through many rounds of legal reviews with Little Brown, including a challenge that came from someone who got a hold of a very early copy of the manuscript. I don't know how, and did not contact me, even though she's known me for 25 years. 35 years. But she contacted my publishing house quite angry and demanded changes. And that was a whole new round of complication. And I will say that for those of us who are writing about issues that we were not allowed to speak speak to earlier in our lives, which is often what seeds a memoir, is the sense that you have not been able to get this story out in a way that people mm-hmm. will bear witness to. Those challenges, while they're perfectly legal and par for the course, can be very troubling. They're very unsettling because it does feel that someone is challenging your experience.
You use the word troubling, and you started with a T, and I really thought you were going with traumatic, because in a way, if what you're talking about is having been silenced so long ago and that having been a formative part of your yes. experience as a woman, as a girl growing into a woman, and now as a person with a set of facts that have been checked and checked and checked, and now someone's coming in right before publication and saying, no, you can't say that.
Well, exactly. And in fact, it was traumatic. It was deeply traumatic. And it was a woman, which made it even harder for me, who brought these challenges. And it concerned a telephone conversation that my mother had had with this woman's father 30 years ago. And I had quoted my mother saying three words about it. And the woman said, those words aren't accurate. That's a complete fiction. I know, because my father told me everything he said on the phone 30 years ago. So I know what he said. Mm-hmm. And I said to the lawyers, that's insane. Nobody knows what anybody said 30 years ago. If you don't have notes and you didn't record it, you have a memory. You might have a vivid memory, but mm-hmm. you don't actually know. And if you weren't on the phone call, you sure as hell don't know. You mm-hmm. know what your father told you. And the lawyer said, oh, of course, you're absolutely right. You know, these claims don't actually make any legal sense. But here's the thing. If you're putting a book in the world and somebody is already coming after you, they said, can we just make whatever change we need to make so that this goes away? Because mm-hmm. we really don't want there to be any suggestion that people can come after you for credibility. So in this instance, they said, we strongly recommend you make the change she's asking for, if you can stomach it, so that we don't have to worry about this.
And for you, was it something that was difficult for you to have to remove, or was it something that you were like, that's fine, whatever?
I mean, it wasn't a whatever, because it was about protecting a man who, to mm-hmm. this day, hasn't stood up for me. And yeah. the whole book is about people in positions of power who at best did not stand up for a child, and at worst, mm-hmm. you know, actively silenced and slandered her. Right. So it was very difficult. And I said, this is exactly what the book is about, you know, right. and they said, right. we know you're putting a book out there. We gotcha. But could you just in this one instance, right? The lawyers are conservative by nature and they do this to protect the writer, but it didn't feel like protection. It felt like an attack in that moment.
Okay. So you've done the legal stuff. You've done now this additional removal. I mean, you are clean, squeaky clean, ready to go out into the magazine.
Like, come at me. I am emerging from the Turkish sauna. I am as clean and scrubbed as I will ever be. And Vanity Fair fact checks. Right? They fact check. And this is not something that Little Brown did. So,
in fact, many magazines like Condé Nast does great fact checking. The New Yorker is known far and wide for its incredibly diligent fact checking. There's a different standard.
There's a completely different standard. And nobody had presented this to me. I had no expectation, you know, of what this would look like. So I'm thrilled because Vanity Fair has cut from my book a beautiful excerpt, a long excerpt, an excerpt that contains within it some of the most painful experiences of my life and some of the passages that I felt were most concise and most lucid about those experiences. And then I hear from a wonderful and brilliant woman who is probably 23 years old, called Charlotte, who's a fact checker. Condé Nast. And Charlotte says, hi, Lacey. I'm so excited to work with you on fact checking. And I was like, well, it's all true. So you're good. We're good. And she said, yeah, but I'm going to fact check this. And here is what that meant. I am not kidding. I had written that my father wore a certain kind of shirt and a certain kind of tie habitually while I was growing up, which, of course, he did. She had to call my father and say, did you really wear this kind of shirt and this kind of tie? Now, that was fine because he did, and he said he did, so it worked out. But remember that the lawyers at my publishing house had said, you know, let's not make people identifiable if we don't have to. So the girl who was in the purple Carmen Ghia is now in a leaf green MG, and Charlotte is like, oh, great, so I'll just call and confirm it was a leaf green MG. And I said, no, you can't, because it wasn't a leaf green MG, because that would be true. And Charlotte said, right. That's what we're doing here. Do you see? So
yeah.
So we're working at cross purposes. And that was really extraordinary for me to witness. And I think there is an example of this that I was floored by, which is that one of the ways that my school threatened me out of testifying against my rapist was they said that if they put me on the stand, the school was going to claim that I was a drug dealer. Mm-hmm. This is laughable to everybody who knew me. I still have never done drugs. That is not my thing. and everyone knew that. And I had written in my memoir how laughable this was, because any student caught dealing drugs on campus would be immediately expelled, right? So the school knew. There's no way that they had been sitting on the information that I was a drug dealer. So Charlotte, because she is doing her job to the nth degree, got a hold of the student guidebook from the year 1990 to 1991. And she got back to me and she said, well, we have a problem because it doesn't say here that students will be immediately expelled for dealing drugs. And I was pacing in my bedroom and I said, Charlotte, does it say they'll be immediately expelled for committing homicide? And she said, well, no. And then I realized that I was being a bit of a brat. And I said, you just trust me on this, that if they were caught dealing drugs? And she said, I'm sorry, it's not that I don't trust you. I have to do my job. Yeah. And if it doesn't say that, then I'm going to have to get a list of everybody who was caught dealing drugs while you were at the school and how many of them were expelled. And if that number is all of them, then we can leave the phrasing as it is. Otherwise, we're going to have to change this.
And she'll be working until the year 2026 to track down all of those people.
Exactly. So what you have to do, you see, is you have to change. You end up changing the phrasing. So in Vanity Fair, the phrase is something like, any student caught dealing drugs would be immediately subjected to a disciplinary proceeding, probably suspended and likely expelled, you know, or something like that. And once we had made all of these little curlicue changes, then they get passed up to the legal department at Condé Nast, which was much more sensitive to defamation risk than Little Brown had been. I'm not sure if that's a cultural thing or if that's a difference between book publishing and magazine publishing. Other people could speak to that. Certainly magazines are considered to be breaking news in a way that mm-hmm. books are not, right? So right. I think the expectation was much stronger. So there were things that were clipped back. Descriptions of my rapists effectively were scaled back in Vanity Fair because Vanity Fair was not comfortable with them, whereas Little Brown had no problem with it. So this process took 3 or 3.5 weeks. And I will say, with the exception of the period of time the book was on submission, was the most painful stretch of time through this entire process.
What's really interesting is that Vanity Fair also published an article on St. Paul's after the Owen LaBrie incident, the Chessie Prout Owen LaBrie incident, that was written by someone who had a connection to the school, which was a very interesting parallel when I was reading your article.
Who had gone there, in fact.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. You said you used a delightful phrase in our first interview about this, was that when it comes to fact-checking, when it comes to legal, that lyricism can save you. And I believe you were talking about just massaging the language a little bit so that it's just a little general where it needs to be. And also you can cover things like the barefoot with the leaf green as opposed to barefoot with the purple. And I think that's a really great way to think about it, that you don't have to end up in a situation where you have what reads like a crime report. You can preserve, you know, purple with bare feet says so much about her, and you can preserve that by being careful with the substitute description that you come up with.
Well, exactly. And I think used properly, these sorts of reviews actually force you back on the thing that you were really trying to depict. So sometimes if we've been writing for a long time, details will come to our heads and we know they're good ones and we put them down without thinking what it is that makes them effective, right? And if you're forced to imagine what makes them effective because you can't use that precise detail, even though it's true, that forces you deeper into your story and what it is exactly you're trying to articulate. So I will say that as a result of these legal reviews, the writing got stronger, absolutely, for sure. And my fear had been that it would be diluted in some way. Mm-hmm. And actually, it went in the other direction. And I will say also that after going through the fact-checking process in particular, when that excerpt went into the world and my phone just died, this is a story I was revealing that was very, very intimate and very salacious and very illegal and something that most people in my life didn't really know about. I felt protected in a way that I would not have felt if I hadn't gone through that process. So it was horrible, but thank heavens for that, because I felt that I had teams of people mm-hmm. who were on my side now and who had put me, you know, they'd really made me run the gauntlet to prove that everything mm-hmm. I said was as it should be.
As we record, it's October, that festive and spooky time of year when novelists prepare to horrify ourselves by trying to write 50,000 words of something new in the month of November. If you're in NaNoWriMo this year, now is a great time to check out Dabble Writing Software, which was specifically designed for plotting and writing fiction. Dabble is extending its free trial throughout the months of October and November, so you can try it out without any fear of losing your work, and it's easy to export everything you've done right out at the end if it's not right for you. But we think it will be. Find out more at dabblewriter.com.
So here's what our listeners like. They like helpful takeaway, nuts and bolts kind of thing. And I can tell you that what I've gotten out of this is I'm right in the middle of right now of trying to figure out what will pitch as first serial and what will go out there as second and third and all that other stuff out there. And realizing also I have to go through really, I just had fact checking just the other day for a book review that I wrote, and it took me an hour to answer all of the questions. And so in my head, I'm now, and that was an 800 word book review. And now I'm trying to extrapolate out to your Vanity Fair piece was like, was it longer than 4,000 words?
It was long. Oh, I think it was almost 5,500 or something. It was very long. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot there, especially given all of the details. So my thinking is now, how do I come up with just the right serial excerpt plus one that may also have a little bit easier time when it comes to the fact checking and review at the magazine or the newspaper or whoever publishes it? Did you actually select the piece, or did your publisher do that, or did your agent do that?
I tried. I tried to cut an excerpt, and my agent cut an excerpt. It is very, very difficult to cut an excerpt from a memoir, at least from mine. Mine was told sort of antiphonally, moving back and forth between when I was 15 and then, you know, when I was in my 40s and writing it. So there's a lot that's presented in backstory and scene. It's hard to jump back and forth in an excerpt. Vanity Fair ended up cutting, there was an extraordinary editor there who ended up cutting what is effectively the most painful timeline from the experience itself, which was me realizing a few days after the assault that I couldn't eat or drink without incredible pain mm-hmm. Because of my throat, and going to the infirmary and visiting doctors, ultimately visiting physicians off campus in Concord, New Hampshire, and asking people to help me, and not knowing at the time that while they knew what was wrong with me, they refused to treat it or tell mm-hmm. me. It's a great magazine piece because it's salacious, you know, right. I would click on that, but that mm-hmm. also makes it uncomfortable. That's uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. So for you, I mean, I've been lucky enough to have a sneak preview of your book. And I mean, I would think that an excerpt, fortunately or unfortunately, cuts to the heart of what is most vulnerable on the page, mm-hmm. right? It's the inner sanctum of the book itself, because that is what will get the most attention in the shortest space of time, which is what a magazine is doing. Right? They don't have they don't have a book.
Well, and what's interesting also about mine is it goes between very memoir and very how-to, here's what you do kind of stuff. And no one wants to read how-to, here's what you want to do for 5,000 words anyway. So you're going to have to do some storytelling.
Or you cut a couple of different excerpts. Right. You actually have different genres of excerpt, which is very interesting. But I do, again, these processes, while they seem to be rote or sort of categorical, ended up becoming part of the narrative experience mm-hmm. for me, because you have to be damn sure what you are choosing to say. You have to understand it aesthetically as a writer. You have to understand it ethically as a human being who has obligations to other human beings. And you have to understand it legally to some extent too. You know, what is it that I can say and what will be distracting?
And what I the part that I think is most going to be most helpful for writers out of all of this is that when you do that first pass, you really have to be doing that for yourself. That first pass cannot be with the commenters in mind or the lawyers in mind or the editor. Really, at first, when you're writing about this stuff, especially when you're writing about something that is so traumatic and so difficult to just get on the page, period. And in fact, you did something really interesting that my students in the rehab, when I taught at a drug and alcohol rehab, used to do a lot, which is to shift from first person to third person perspective when the going gets really difficult. And it did something really interesting in your narrative. But I'm just so in awe of someone who can get that kind of information down on the page, those sorts of memories down on the page, and then also deal with the nitpicky suits that are going to have to trample over your words later on.
They do trample. They do. They are bulls in china shops, but they do that because then your shelves are unbreakable, right? I mean, yeah. that's such a crappy metaphor, but I do think in drafting, you can't. I have friends who have written memoirs and they send the first three chapters to their mom because they're really proud. And that, to me, you might as well put the thing in the shredder. Like, I don't know how you can. I don't think you can go outward like that at that stage of the game. I really don't. So it is a battle because our experiences are ours and we are entitled to them. But that is not the same thing as putting a book into the world.
It's also one of the things I have since found out is that no one saw my book until it was in second pass galley form. And while I've had plenty of time to process this, a lot of this is new information for people that I love. And it's sort of like, I draw the analogy that it's like you have a car accident in the morning and you're just putting off telling your spouse about it till that evening. And by that evening, you're like, yeah, I had a car accident this morning.
I'm okay.
Everybody's fine,
okay.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But it's new information for them.
Yes.
So we can't expect them to be. So all of a sudden, I'm telling my spouse about things I hid from him when I was drinking, when I was at my worst. And that was, it's not only shocking information, it is personally shocking to a lot of people. And there are a lot of people that are involved in your story who would be hearing it for the first time, and a lot of opportunities for people to take umbrage with the way you handled it. So I'm incredibly grateful to you for telling the story. And I know that there are lots of other people who are incredibly grateful to you for telling that story as well. I'm also just so grateful that you did it in such a beautiful, lyrical, and honest way, because these books are, you know, we talk about this a lot on the podcast, that your book can't be your therapist, that there's a need to come to the book when you have processed enough so that you can be careful and strategic about how you write the work. And I'm just so grateful that you've done this, and Chantal Miller did this so beautifully in her telling of the story about her rape at Stanford. And I hope that it inspires other people to tell their stories as well, and especially tell their stories without worrying about the lawyers and the suits on the first pass.
I think worry about them at the very end, after you finish celebrating your book deal. That's when you start worrying about it. But thank you so much. And thank you for reading and for being engaged by my story.
I'm terribly engaged by your story. I've been recommending it all over the place. So go out and get yourself a copy of Notes on a Silencing. And Lacey, where can people find you if they want to find out more about your work?
So website is LaceyCrawford.com. There's no E in my name. There's a nice Lacey Crawford who lives in Alabama who's tired of getting sexual assault stories. So send it please to LacyCrawford.com. I have email there. I'm pretty active on Twitter, which is also Lacey Crawford. I'm absolutely terrible at Instagram and Facebook, but I'll be happy to look at your pictures. If you can find me, I don't even know what my handles are.
Excellent. Thanks again for being on the show. And oh my goodness, this is just so inspiring to me.
Thank
and I got to get to work.
Much. Good luck.
Thank you.
And
until next week, everyone, keep your butts in the chair and your head in the game.
Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Save. Pause.
Stop.
Thank you.